Hey, deserving listeners, this is chapter 2 in my deep dive on schizotypal personality disorder. And as an introduction, I thought I would read a real case of someone with schizotypal as a way of grounding all of this talk in reality. So this is a real case that I have permission to share with y'all. So reading their statement. For most of my life, I have felt different from other people. And recently, I figured out why. It's because I have schizotypal personality disorder. Let me explain. I have massive social anxiety to the point where I'm constantly paranoid that people are thinking terrible thoughts about me, even people I've never met before. I've learned that it's best if I just do things on my own. I live alone, I work alone. Sure, I have some friends from school, but I neglect those friendships. All right, so just chiming in here. We're hearing about the social anxiety that is present with schizotypal. We're also hearing about the paranoia and the suspiciousness that is present with schizotypal with most people who suffer from schizotypal. We're also hearing that this individual has learned to turn away from relationships, not because they want to be alone, but because after many, many years, maybe decades of struggling with this paranoia and having a lot of negative experiences in relationships, they've decided to turn away, maybe even convince themselves that they don't need anyone in their life. It doesn't sound like that the person is that far down the road, but I've seen that as well. All right, just going on here. For many years, I've turned to the internet as the place where I socialize. I sometimes get obsessed with a particular subreddit, particularly subreddits that confirm my paranoia of others, like conspiracy theories and so on. People sometimes tell me that I have no expression in my voice, and I talk in an overly formal manner, even with family members. All right, just chiming in here. So we're hearing also about the isolation of the internet, because it is easier for people with schizotypal perhaps to socialize on there because it's more controlled. Also, there's a lot of other paranoid individuals on the internet that you could be paranoid with. And also we're hearing about people sometimes tell me that I have no expression in my voice. Not everyone with schizotypal has this quality, but many do. Certainly odd behavior is a hallmark. Overly formal speech is a common enough symptom that I've seen before. Not everyone has that, but odd speaking in general is a hallmark of schizotypal. Going on here. I didn't have the best childhood. My parents were constantly fighting, and let's just say they didn't raise me very well, to the point where I just kept to myself as a child. All right, just chiming in here. We'll get into etiology and the causal factors in this episode, this chapter on schizotypal. So more on that later in terms of trauma. But the vast majority, well, I will say every single person that I've treated with schizotypal had an extremely difficult early childhood going on here. I also have weird sort of hallucinations. It's hard to explain. I've been this way my whole life, but sometimes I feel things, like feeling the air around me or feeling like the stars are talking to me, but I don't really hear their words, the stars. It's more like I know they're trying to tell me something. Sometimes I get really into this sort of thing and it will completely dominate my life. End of description. That is an example of the odd perceptions and also magical thinking that can be present with people with schizotypal. And also, you don't hear full-blown psychosis. You don't hear the individual saying that they had full, very elaborate, well-understood conversations with the stars. They just felt kind of like the stars were trying to tell them something. So it's in the direction of an auditory hallucination or a delusion, but it's not full-blown. It doesn't meet the criteria for schizophrenia, for example, based on that description. So that is a description from someone of their own schizotypal personality disorder. It's just one description. It's not the description, but I picked it because I think that it is kind of in that middle zone. There's a lot of people with schizotypal will be able to relate to part, if not all, of that description. I wanted to provide that to help people understand what this can look like. And I'll provide some more detailed explanations from other types of people in this deep dive. So as I said, in this chapter, I'm going to be talking about the causes of schizotypal personality disorder. It's hard to lock down. There's a fair amount of research on this, and I have my own idea. I have my own model. That's the wonderful thing about doing deep dives like this, is it gives me a chance to really look at the research, look at the literature, think about my own clinical experience, integrate it with every other main model that I follow when it comes to personality and development. And I did that here, and I have a very, at least at this point in my career, or my understanding of schizotypal, I have a pretty satisfying model of understanding how this develops. Satisfying to me, maybe not satisfying to you, but often that is an outgrowth from this deep dive, is I feel like I have a deeper understanding of the disorder, where it comes from, how it develops, and thus a better, more precise pathway to treatment. Because when you understand why it develops within the personality, what sort of experiences or traumas or personality traits or ideas develop in these individuals that lead to schizotypal, then you understand what to target, you understand what to dismantle, you understand what corrective experiences the individual might need, and you understand where their behavior comes from rather than just looking at it as a set of criteria, right? So as I said in the previous chapter, some of you might be thinking, well, you know, this disorder isn't very common, so what's the big deal? And what I'll say is that some research suggests that 10% of people have at least traits of schizotypal. You know, it's a lot of people, 1 in 10 individuals. And when I consider that research or that suggestion, it really explains a lot that I see not only on the internet and in society and in politics, but also in my friend group, in my family. There are individuals that have often confused me, and I don't know if they have schizotypal. Of course, I can't diagnose them because I'm not assessing them clinically, but it does raise some questions, and it does provide some comfort in a weird way to have some way of conceptualizing these individuals. So let's get into chapter 2, but this is going to be for patrons of the podcast only. So if you want to listen to the rest of this episode and this whole deep dive, all the chapters, you have to be a patron of the podcast by going to patreon.com. When you become a patron, you get access to this episode along with the other chapters and the hundreds of other deep dives that I've done, and also know that a portion of your monthly pledge goes toward various charities that we support. So if you want to hear this, become a patron. If not, super cool. Take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do. All right, so we ended chapter 1 with discussing all the DSM-5 criteria, and I've been alluding to the fact that I have this hot take on the DSM-5, which I've basically already described, but to go into more detail, I believe, and I didn't know this until, I didn't have this opinion until I did this deep dive, but it's my opinion that schizotypal, as it's described in the clinical literature and in the DSM, is describing at least two different, very different disorders, in my opinion, that look similar but are very different. For example, in order to qualify for the disorder, you have to have 5 or more of the symptoms, right? Well, there are 9 symptoms. So let me provide 2 different individuals that qualify for the disorder that are very, very different presentations, very, very different disorders, in my opinion. Okay, so the first is what I will call the classic personality disorder presentation. So the first person is a loner. They are paranoid about what other people are thinking about them. They have a ton of social anxiety. They have some odd behavior, and they have magical thinking, meaning that they will think that they have special powers or that trees are talking to them, this sort of thing. So this is one example of an individual who, what I would call, suffers from schizotypal personality disorder. It's stable over time. It's pervasive. They have a perceptual distortion of other people. It's egocentric, meaning, you know, the distortions feel right to them. So this individual is schizotypal personality disorder. You can have another person that also qualifies for the disorder, but in my opinion, they should be labeled as, we don't really have a label for it. It should be like mild schizophrenia, or you could expand schizophreniform to include these individuals. But these individuals, in my opinion, are more definitely in the schizophrenia spectrum and not in the... So basically, the personality disorder, in my opinion, is derived from traumas, relational traumas growing up. And they might have had a genetic disposition for it, but their distortions about other people and their magical thinking and their odd behavior is explained by relational trauma and isn't explained in the ways that we typically will explain schizophrenia or bipolar with psychosis. Typically with those disorders, we're often talking about genetic dispositions, maybe with trauma exacerbating or causing an onset of the symptoms, for sure, but we're when we're talking about personality disorders, it's in terms of etiology, we're usually talking about, in my opinion, we should be talking about a very different genesis as opposed to psychotic disorders. And that's why I think schizotypal is so confusing to people, because on one hand, and especially in the clinical literature, it can really depend on the author. They can be talking about it very much in the camp of schizophrenia, or they can be talking about it very much in the camp of a typical personality disorder like borderline or histrionic, right? So another person who can qualify for the disorder, again, five of the symptoms. So this individual has mild hallucinations. They have ideas of reference, meaning they think everything is a reference to them. They have odd speech, they have odd behavior, and they have constricted affect. If you had those five symptoms, you would qualify for schizotypal personality disorder. But in my opinion, if they don't have the paranoia about other people's thoughts about them, if they don't have the quintessential loner aspect or the quintessential magical thinking of schizotypal, then I would say, even though this person qualifies for schizotypal personality disorder, there should be another label for these individuals, like mild schizophrenia or psychotic disorder not otherwise specified or something like that. And I think when we include both of these individuals under the umbrella of schizotypal personality disorder, it dilutes the construct and also makes it very difficult to research. It also makes it very difficult to treat, because if someone came into me with a second presentation, again, mild hallucinations, ideas of reference, odd speech, odd behavior, constricted affect, I would not conclude, and it would be hard to know, but generally speaking, I would, and I've been in this position clinically, I would not conclude that my version of therapy, my specialty, would help them with these symptoms. I would conclude, in all likelihood, we're looking at someone that needs to manage their symptoms through medication, possibly through supportive therapy, possibly, in all likelihood, we have to involve the family. We have to have some potential occupational therapy. You know, there's basically, it's they suffer from an organic problem with their brain that we need to manage. Whereas someone who came to me with the first presentation, someone who has what I would call schizotypal personality disorder, this individual will benefit from my version of therapy, which is, you know, two pillars, two prongs. One is a self-awareness. So I'd really work on their ability to differentiate and have self-awareness around their emotions and their thoughts and their assumptions. And then also a lot of corrective experiences where they can have experiences that show them that other people are not thinking ill of them and other people are not conspiring against them, mainly through their relationship with me, right? And I've done that with schizotypal individuals, and they have recovered to some extent through those experiences, not only through the self-awareness, but also through the corrective experience. And to me, these two presentations, these two disorders, if I could be so bold to differentiate between them, are so different that I would just completely different recommendations. If someone came into me with mild schizophrenia, in all likelihood, I would not treat them. I would actually refer them to psychiatry and other individuals who focus on med management and that sort of, I wouldn't necessarily reject them, but it's reject is bad, refer them. But it definitely wouldn't be within my wheelhouse. It's not within my expertise, really. It's not even within what I prefer to work with. It's not what I got into this business for. Whereas the first person, the person with the paranoia and the social anxiety and the magical thinking and the isolation from other people because they assume everyone is thinking bad about them, that's completely within my wheelhouse, because I specialize in personality disorders and early childhood relational trauma and schemas and that sort of thing. And I would actually be quite happy to work with that individual. So I think to delineate between these two different people is, I think, really critical. And this problem of melding these two presentations together, I think, goes way back. And I think we're still wrestling with it in the field. Now, could a researcher convince me otherwise and say, no, you don't really understand? Because, yeah, there are different models. There are different ways of understanding the brain. This delineation between traumas and genetics, you know, the wording I used earlier is just like, you know, schizophrenia is an organic issue. Okay, what does that mean, organic? Because personality emerges from our brain, from organic issues, you know. There's no line between our psychologies, our minds, our personalities, and our brain. It's all one and the same, right? So, you know, it gets complicated. And could I be convinced? You know, I don't know if I could be convinced, but I could be convinced that someone else was standing on solid ground, but I for me, when I treat people, when I assess people, and when I decide to work with people, the delineation between these two different, what I'm going to call different disorders, is important. So another way of delineating between what I'm going to call mild schizophrenia and schizotypal personality disorder is where the symptoms are coming from and where they are headed. So we can never know this, particularly in a point in time, but if it seems likely that the schizotypal symptoms are coming from relational traumas that are that developed schemas that are informing perspectives and distortions and thus all the symptoms of schizotypal, then we're looking at a personality disorder. If the symptoms seem to come out of nowhere, meaning they don't come out of early childhood experiences that would have taught the individual that other people are out to get them, then we're looking at potentially what I would call mild schizophrenia. The other question is, where are the symptoms headed? Now, you can't know in one particular moment where they're headed, but or it'd be hard to know. But if you treated someone over time, you would start to see some course to their symptoms. If the individual shows what are considered by me to be mild schizophrenia, even though they qualify for schizotypal, and over time they have increased hallucinations, more intense delusions that are starting, they're moving away from the, I feel like someone's talking to me, to someone's actually talking to me, then we can retroactively go back and say, well, when we assessed them that first time, we were looking at mild schizophrenia because eventually it went into schizophrenia. Whereas if over time we see a fairly stable personality and not an increase in psychosis, and we see a very stable, pervasive assumption about what is going on in other people's minds, and a lot of the symptoms of schizotypal are based on that perceptual distortion, then we have more evidence that we're looking at a personality disorder and not mild schizophrenia. Yeah, there's a huge debate in our field about this, and it's been going on for decades. But I just wanted to I wanted to commit to that here, because moving forward, I'm going to be talking about the personality disorder. And if you look at the clinical literature, a lot of it is oriented towards this mild schizophrenia. I'm going to exclude that. Maybe I'll do a deep dive on schizophrenia and mild schizophrenia. And in that episode, I'll talk about how, well, some of these people might actually qualify for schizotypal, even though I don't think they should be. So, I can talk about that another time, but I want to focus on what I believe to be a personality disorder. Mild schizophrenia has nothing to do with a pervasive pattern of personality. That's why, we don't call schizophrenia a personality disorder, right? So why would mild schizophrenia be a personality disorder? And along these lines, in the ICD-10, which is the alternative to DSM, schizotypal personality disorder is a type of schizophrenia disorder. And I think this is another piece of evidence pointing towards, when we're saying schizotypal personality disorder, we're talking about two different things. Because in the DSM, it's in the personality disorder chapter, but in the ICD-10, it's in the schizophrenia chapter. And to me, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, maybe in the future, and maybe people today could convince me, that schizophrenia and personality disorders are all kind of in the same zone. Some people will say that borderline is in the schizophrenia area. And yeah, I could be convinced of someone's perspective that it's sound to them. I wouldn't be convinced myself, but I would be convinced that, okay, well, you're standing on solid ground. I'm standing on a different ground that I've established in terms of how I see things. And maybe in 100 years or 50 years, we'll have the resolution to study the brain to answer these questions more closely. But at this point, I want to delineate between the two of them. Okay, so before going on to etiology, I just want to take a second and talk about the name schizotypal, because I think if you understand where the name comes from, then I think it helps to understand what it is. And part of this was just my own curiosity. As I was doing this deep dive, I was like, I think I learned this a long time ago, but I forgot. It's like, well, where does the word schizo come from? That word base? It's from Greek, as a lot of things in our scientific field, right? So it comes from the word schizo or schiza or something. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's spelled S-C-H-I-Z-A. And it apparently in ancient Greek referred to a split piece of wood. So a skiza or a skitsa was a split piece of wood. So it meant split. All right. So let's look at schizophrenia. So schizophrenia comes from the Greek meaning splitting of the mind. So schizo meaning splitting and phrenia, phren, meaning mind. Other words with phren in it that have to do with the mind would be phrenology, which was the study, if I'm remembering right, the bumps on your head trying to understand your mind, which was debunked by science, of course, and also frenetic, which I think means active mind, I think is maybe what it comes from. But anyway, so schizophrenia, splitting of the mind. And maybe this is why people will often think schizophrenia means dissociative identity disorder or multiple personality disorder, because they think that the personality has been split into different people, different alters. But what I think they were referring to with the origin of the term schizophrenia, or at least the way I guess it eventually became, is that the person has a split from reality, right? That when they're asymptomatic, they're in touch with objective reality, and then they will become split from that and have psychosis where they believe that aliens are getting them and that they can see things, so they're split from reality. I think that's what it means anyway. So let's look at schizotypal. Another word that's similar to schizotypal is schizotypy, which I'll get into later, schizotypy. But schizotypal was coined by Sandor Rado in 1953 as an abbreviation of the term schizophrenic phenotype. In a nutshell, what he was referring to was when he used the term schizophrenic phenotype, he was saying these individuals have mild schizophrenia or borderline schizophrenia. So when you think schizotypal, the original term was schizophrenic phenotype, and that was referring to mild schizophrenia, which I think has to do with the confusion between schizophrenia and the personality disorder. Another term that uses schizo in the DSM is schizophreniform disorder, which comes from the Greek outward appearance of split mind or outward appearance of schizophrenia. So schizophreniform, if you don't know, is basically short-term schizophrenia, like 3 months. It's often a precursor to schizophrenia, but that's what schizophreniform means. So people would say like, well, it kind of looks like they have schizophrenia, but they've only had it for this brief amount of time, so we can't really diagnose them with schizophrenia. So we'll diagnose them with the label that means outward appearance of schizophrenia or schizophreniform. Another diagnosis in DSM-5 is schizoaffective disorder. This comes from the Greek meaning split emotion. So schizo, split, affective, emotion. And by the way, schizoaffective might be on a spectrum of schizophrenia and bipolar, where you have schizophrenia on one end and bipolar without psychosis on the other end. And so you have, if we move from schizophrenia to bipolar without psychosis, you have schizophrenia at one end, psychosis, and then you have schizoaffective disorder, which is schizophrenia with some depression and mania. Then you have what we will call bipolar with psychosis. So this is someone, it's sort of like, when I was growing up in the Crayola crayons, we had bluish green and greenish blue. And what's the difference? Well, if you have bluish green, it's green, but it has some blue tint to it. Whereas you have greenish blue, then you're looking at blue with some green in it, right? So with schizoaffective, you have schizophrenia with some bipolar in it. And if you have bipolar with psychosis, then you have bipolar with some psychosis or schizophrenia in it. Does that make sense? And then you have bipolar without psychosis. And there's some debate, a lot of debate, as to whether or not that spectrum is viable, but it seems totally viable to me when I read the research and think about it and treat people. Another DSM label, there's a lot of schizo in the DSM-5, right? So you have schizoid or schizoid. So this is another personality disorder. And this comes from the Greek meaning split seeming or resembling schizophrenia, coined by Eugen Bleuler in 1908, describing people who split off from others, like a shut-in, okay? So schizoid are individuals that are very isolated and they split off from others. All right. There's another word in our psychology field called schizothymic. And this comes from the Greek words meaning split spirit or split disposition. So you have schizo, split, and thymic, meaning spirit or disposition or self. So schizothymic means split disposition. Split. Okay. Coined in the 1920s by Ernst Kretschmer. We don't use this term anymore, at least in my circle. I don't hear the term schizothymic, but it was used in the early 20th century. For the record, schizothymic is defined by reduced affect on display, meaning, you know, there's constricted affect. There's severe introversion, there's limited social skills, and withdrawing from social relations. It's likely that people who were labeled schizothymic in the 20s would be labeled schizotypal personality disorder today, based on that description, right? So a lot of the words in the DSM involving the phrase schizo are related to each other. Schizophrenia, schizotypal, schizophreniform, schizoaffective, schizoid, schizothymic. So if we don't look at schizothymic, which is basically just schizotypal, let me categorize things a little bit. So in my opinion, schizotypal should not be equated with schizophrenia very strongly. So a lot of people do, of course, but I don't think it should be based on what I was saying earlier, right? So the things that should be together are schizophrenia, schizophreniform, which is a short-term version of schizophrenia, schizoaffective, which is schizophrenia with some mood shifts, and also the psychosis might be related to the mood shifts, right? So those ones, right? So you have schizoaffective, schizophreniform, and schizophrenia. Those should all be related to each other as evidenced by the fact that they sound similar, right? Now, schizotypal and schizotyp. So I'll get into schizotypy later, and you could say schizotypy kind of is between both of this, the schizophrenia area and the schizotypal area. But schizotypal and schizothymic should be related to each other, and schizoid should be in its own category altogether. I kind of wish that schizotypal and schizothymic didn't use the phrase schizo, and I wish that schizoid didn't use the term schizo either, because to confuse them with schizophrenia, I think, confuses people. Now, there are a lot of other words in the sciences that involve the term schizo, and I don't know how to pronounce any of these because I've never heard any of them said out loud, and I don't want to bother to look into it, so I'm just going to kind of butcher these words, but I thought it'd be fun to look at some other words that involve the phrase schizo. A lot of these are from biology. So you have schizaxon or schizaxon, which is an axon that divides into two nearly equal branches, according to the internet, that's what they say. Or schizont, which is a cell that divides by schizogeny. You have schizogeny with an E, which is asexual reproduction by multiple segmentation. Schizogenesis, which is a fission-like form of asexual reproduction, in which new organisms are created but no original is left behind. There are plants like schizophragma, or if you have two tendons in one toe or something like that, you're schizopelmus or something. I don't know. There's just a lot of different things in biology involving the term schizo or schizo. And you can clearly see the theme, which is that things that use the term schizo are things that are split into two. All right, so now let's go into etiology or causal factors in schizotypal personality disorder. Let's talk about heritability. Various twin studies and other studies, but a lot of twin studies have demonstrated that schizotypal personality disorder has the highest heritability among cluster A personality disorders. Basically, in a nutshell, it's found that schizotypal has a lot of genetic factors that are important to the development of schizotypal personality disorder. It's not a single gene, it's seemingly a number of genes, or the interaction of all these things with the environment, epigenetics, you know, the whole thing. So in other words, if you have twins that are raised in different environments and one has schizotypal, then there's a pretty good chance that the other twin, even though they were raised in a completely different environment, also will have schizotypal. Now, it's not guaranteed that if one twin has schizotypal that the other one will as well, but there's a high likelihood that they will. Various different studies will find various different percentages, but it's somewhere in the area of 50-60% of twins raised in different households, if one has schizotypal, 50-60% of the time the other one will as well. And what does that tell us? Well, it's really hard to answer that question. Like, what does that mean? A lot of people say, like, well, that means that, you know, the factors involved in the development of schizotypal, it's 60% related to genetics, and that's it's not accurate and it's oversimplistic. It's anyway, the point is that just know that with schizotypal, as with a lot of disorders in the DSM, including personality disorders, it seems to run in families. So if you have parents or siblings that have schizotypal, then your risk of developing schizotypal is increased. All right, so that's heritability. Now let's look more broadly at just biology in general. I've looked at a lot of research in my deep dive in this area. Some of it I get and understand. Some of it I do not get or understand. But one study, for example, found that when they looked at people with schizotypal personality disorder, on average, these individuals had less gray matter in their brain than other people. Gray matter is associated with your cognitive abilities. It's the cortex of your brain. It's the area that does a lot of the work. And so these individuals seem to have less, but it's on average. You know, many people, I'm guessing, I didn't look at the specific data points, but you could have schizotypal and yet have the normal amount of gray matter, maybe even more than average. So it's not a slam dunk indication that schizotypal is caused by lower gray matter, that kind of thing. Another biological factor involved might be insults to the brain or injuries to the brain. So along these lines, there's evidence that the following factors can contribute to the risk of developing schizotypal personality disorder. We have low birth weight, also getting flu while pregnant. If the parent gets the flu while pregnant, that raises the risk of the child developing schizotypal later in life. Also, prenatal malnutrition can be a risk factor in developing schizotypal. Other perinatal complications. Also, evidence shows that children born in the winter or autumn months are slightly more likely to develop schizotypal. I'm not exactly sure why that would be. I'm guessing there are some speculations as that. And also, smoking during pregnancy can raise the risk of the child developing schizotypal. So the idea is that anything that can affect the nervous system, particularly early in life as it's developing, can result in raising the risk of a lot of different disorders, a lot of different issues later in life, including schizotypal. Okay, so far we're talking in very similar ways as we would to any personality disorder. We're talking about heritability, we're talking about biological factors, and along those lines, we're also going to talk about early childhood trauma and mistreatment as a known factor in the development of a personality disorder, including schizotypal. There's lots of research showing an association between schizotypal personality disorder and childhood mistreatment. Basically, the hypothesis is that the severe trauma affects the child, the child's ability to make sense of reality, right? So you're a child and you're being mistreated, you're being gaslit, you're experiencing what in family therapy we would call double binds, which are these experiences where you know, one example is that you have a parent that is saying, come to me, but the nonverbal from the parent is rejection. And so the child is getting these, you know, are getting these two different crazy making messages that causes the child to, they need to cope with that somehow, right? And it really kind of messes them up. So, you know, another element of this is that when you're treated poorly, particularly if it's sporadic, right? It can be kind of random where you might be a good boy that day and yet you get abused. You might be a bad boy the next day and you don't get abused. But then the next day you're a bad boy and you get really abused. And the next day you're a good boy and you get treated well. So in the child's world, nothing makes sense, particularly in the way people talk, right? People say, well, you only get punished when you're a bad boy, but you're just like, but what is bad and what is good? And I don't understand. And you repeat this, and there are a lot of nuances, obviously, to this. The child doesn't get a sense of what is real and what is not real because they're not shown that, right? They're not given a chance to delineate between reality and non-reality. And thus, that can be a factor in the neurological development or the neurological underpinnings of schizotypal personality disorder. Also, the severe trauma can cause the child to retreat into fantasy, where they turn to magical thinking and fantasy and made up things in order just to cope, in order to have friends, in order to entertain themselves. Also, the severe trauma can cause a child to develop schemas of paranoia and avoidance of relationships, right? The mistreatment causes them to believe, well, generally speaking, people are against me, because when they're a young child, that is true. People are usually against them. They are conspiring against the child. And so they just lock that in as an assumption. It's better to assume that everyone is against you than to not, and then be blindsided. So along these lines, research by Yen and colleagues in 2002, they looked at all personality disorders and found that borderline personality disorder and schizotypal personality disorder are associated with the highest rates of trauma and physical assault. So that's evidence in this direction. And there are a lot of studies, but these are some highlights. Other studies found that schizotypal personality disorder is associated with early childhood neglect in particular, and I'll get to more of that later. Neglect seems to be, and it makes total sense, right? That when you're neglected, you have to retreat into fantasy. When you're neglected, you don't get to develop a sense of emotions. You don't have that attunement. When you're neglected, you have to cope with the fact that no one is paying attention to your emotions, and so it feels like everyone's against you. It just makes sense that neglect would be a pretty big factor. Could someone with schizotypal have experienced minimal neglect and more along the lines of just classic physical abuse? Yeah, absolutely. It just depends on how the child interprets it, right? It depends on what the lessons they're pulling away. Also associated with schizotypal are undesired pregnancies. So let's say you have a mother who has a pregnancy and is not happy about it. Well, why would that be associated with schizotypal? Well, when you are in a situation where you are pregnant and you don't want the child, you're more stressed out. In all likelihood, there are a lot of external stressors like potentially poverty or maybe even abuse in your relationship or drug addiction. Not always, of course, but it raises the chances of that. And thus, when the child is born, then those things are going to affect the parent's ability to parent. Also, when you have a parent who is ambivalent about the child to begin with, then that on average is going to affect the amount of attunement that they give to that child, right? So another factor associated with schizotypal are childhood poverty or low socioeconomic status for similar reasons, right? When as a parent, you're suffering from poverty, when you have low socioeconomic status, you're struggling to make ends meet. You might be working two different jobs. You might not have enough money to pay for healthcare or for a daycare, for childcare. You know, there's just a lot of stresses, and those stresses are going to pull you away from having the capacity or the time to pay attention to your child, which leads to neglect, potentially abuse, that kind of thing. Also along these lines, Lysaker and colleagues 2010 conducted a study and found that schizotypal personality disorder is associated with migration and minority status. So why would migrating as a family, or why would being in a minority group, why would that be associated with schizotypal? Well, the speculation is that because of those stresses, again, it pulls the parent away from the child, and thus it creates the environment in which schizotypal can emerge. And incidentally, a lot of disorders in the DSM are associated with these factors that I'm talking about, which really gives us even more reason, other than just our own compassion, to really care for people who are migrating, who are suffering from poverty, who are minorities. It's important for us to help people in these groups because there are a lot of effects downstream that can result from these experiences because of the oppression, because of the mistreatment, because the system doesn't help these individuals. You know, there's nothing inherently problematic about being in a minority, right? It's only because the society and the legal system and the health system and the societal system, the work system, political system, they will all have elements that will systematize the oppression of these individuals and thus stress out the parents, and thus the children will potentially develop neurological issues such as schizotypal personality disorder because of that. Another study by Vell and Kanja and colleagues in 2014, they looked at schizotypal personality disorder and reported childhood trauma. So they would go to people with schizotypal and they would ask them how much trauma and to what degree they went through as children. And then they had a control group to compare to. And it was a pretty lengthy, very detailed results in this study, but I just want to highlight some important bullet points here to demonstrate what I'm trying to get across, which is that mainly neglect was, so, you know, they delineated between emotional abuse, between you know, neglect, physical neglect, emotional neglect, sexual abuse, physical abuse, physical neglect, this kind of thing. And what they found was that, in different degrees, and what they found was that the more emotional neglect you went through, the more physical neglect you went through, the more likelihood you were seemingly to develop schizotypal personality disorder. Because a lot of people with schizotypal would report very high rates of physical and emotional neglect as compared to controls. So let's look at the specific numbers. So with emotional neglect, with the control group, which I find to be interesting, just this fact that just among non, you know, people without schizotypal, just, you know, just what they would call healthy controls in the study, but they could have a different personality disorder. But 29% of the control group reported emotional neglect. 29% to some degree were emotionally neglected growing up. That's a lot of people. But people with schizotypal, 75% reported emotional neglect growing up. So it's quite a big difference. 29% in the control and 75% in, among those with schizotypal. Physical neglect was a lower percentage by the control. They said they were 14% were, you know, they reported physical neglect, and 55% of the schizotypal group reported physical neglect. So it's important. Another highlight to this was emotional abuse, which is control group 23% reported emotional abuse, but the schizotypal group 68% reported emotional abuse. So most people with schizotypal, the vast majority really, will report emotional neglect. A lower percentage, but still 2/3 plus will report emotional abuse, and just over half will report physical neglect. So to me, what I pull, this confirms what the way I conceptualize schizotypal, which is that when you're being abused emotionally and when you're being emotionally neglected, when meaning emotional neglect is when the children aren't being attuned to and they're not having their emotional needs met. They're not being paid attention to. They're not being played with. They're not getting any kind of emotional attunement like, oh, I see that you're sad, or how are you doing today? Or you're happy. Let's talk about that. There's none of that. Then the child is left to their own devices and they have to develop this fantasy life. And I'll get into later in terms of what I believe to be at least one way in which the flow chart of development will happen, because I think it is kind of a step-by-step process. Now, some of you smart people out there might be saying, hey, this is just self-report childhood abuse. It's not actual childhood abuse. You're asking the control group, have you been abused? Do you remember having been abused? And then you're asking people with a personality disorder, schizotypal, have you been abused? If they've been abused in the past, you don't know if they've been abused in the past. It's just self-report. People with schizotypal, by definition, have a perceptual distortion and thus might distort what happened to them in the past as abuse when they actually didn't go through that. Well, Johnson and colleagues in 2000 tried to look at this, and the researchers analyzed assessments for children and their parents in New York State from 1975 to 1993. These assessments included non-self-report data like state-verified documentation of childhood mistreatment. So this robust longitudinal study tried to get at actual data outside of the report of the individual with schizotypal if these individuals had been through abuse. And what they found was that childhood emotional neglect, physical neglect, and supervision neglect, so all the different types of neglect, was associated with an increased risk of developing any personality disorder at all. So all the personality disorders were associated particularly with emotional neglect, physical neglect, and supervision neglect. And again, this isn't self-report. This is looking at reports from social workers or parent, or family members, this kind of thing, teachers. Also, childhood physical neglect was associated with an increased risk, in particular for schizotypal. So again, we're looking at another form of neglect as being a particular factor in the development of schizotypal. So not only do we hear it from the people with schizotypal, but we also have this outside evidence that, yes, childhood mistreatment, particularly neglect, leads to personality disorders in general, and particularly schizotypal. Okay, so here's the big shebang. Is that a word? Here's the big conclusion to etiology or cause or the factors involved in the development of schizotypal. So to me, this is the core of the whole deep dive. When I discovered this, or I don't know if discover is the right word, but when I pieced this together in my own mind, and there's no way to know if any of this is right. There's a lot of evidence that this is correct, or at least a viable conceptualization. But when I landed on this, it was a big aha moment for me. where I understood the disorder. Because, you know, if you just read the nine symptoms in DSM, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like, okay, ideas of reference, odd beliefs, unusual perceptions, odd thinking, odd speech, suspiciousness, inappropriate affect, constricted affect. How does all this fit together? And if you look at it as a mild schizophrenia, they're just like, well, you know, the brain's weird and there's something wrong with the brain. But if we're going to talk about a personality disorder, then we're really talking about, in my view and a lot of other people, we're talking about traumas and schemas that set up a personality perspective that down the line of behavior and experiences results in what we see as the nine symptoms. So when I discovered or when I fell on this conceptualization, I was like, oh, I get schizotypal. And I've had similar experiences with all the other personality disorders. When I'm given a chance to really do a deep dive, and with some disorders that I specialized in, like narcissistic and with borderline, histrionic, this kind of thing, I came to this realization a long, long time ago. You know, when you hear the symptoms of borderline, you're like, huh, impulsiveness, black and white thinking, why are these things holding together within a set of people? But when you understand for borderline individuals, it all stems from betrayal and rejection trauma, right? Abandonment trauma. And you understand the pathway to all the different symptoms that people identify, it makes total sense to me. And so let's go through what I believe to be, at least at my current understanding or my current conceptualization, how this develops. Okay, so the first thing is, and by the way, this is based on research, but also my own experience. And again, this is assuming the schizotypal personality disorder, not the mild schizophrenia, if those two things are different, which I'm contending. Number one, you start out with a biological disposition. In all likelihood, everyone with schizotypal has a biological disposition, either due to genetics and heritability or injuries and insults to the brain in early neurodevelopment or both. It's hard to know, but it seems likely, and I'm just going to include that. Because to me, the experiences of someone with schizotypal are not particularly unique. I mean, we're talking about mistreatment, we're talking about abuse, and there's a lot of different things that stem from that, right? A lot of personality disorders in and of itself. So why schizotypal? Well, it stands to reason that the individual experiencing the mistreatment goes in a particular direction because of their genetic disposition, right? That's the difference. Anyway, so you have that biological, you're born with that disposition. That alone will not develop into schizotypal. The second thing that needs to happen is neglect. In particular, right? Not just general abuse, but neglect. Could they also be abused? Yes, but there has to be, in my model, some form of neglect, either due to parenting style, like the parents just are not very good at parenting, or their own parenting attachment style, the way they were raised, or parenting stress, like unwanted pregnancy, poverty, oppression, this kind of thing. So you could have a parent who has all the ability to be a good enough parent for their child. But because of outside influences, maybe health problems the parent is going through, the child will experience enough neglect that when matched up with the biological disposition will start the ball rolling. All right. So, but these two things, not enough. There needs to be other things that happen in the individual personality of the child. So as a result of this neglect, the child feels under threat. This is important to focus on. So due to the neglect they're going through, they feel a constant state of threat. They feel like, you know, they're in danger, right? Now, there's a lot of reasons as to why this would happen. One is because children innately feel afraid of the world. And this is something that we often forget. But if you have young children, you at least observe this, if not fully understand it. And I can remember feeling this way. I remember feeling when I was 2-3 years old, the world was just terrifying. You know, everyone was so tall and everything was so unknown to me. I didn't know how to do anything on my own. And it's a scary place. Now, in an ideal world, or ideal enough, your parents are there to protect you. And so whenever there's any danger, you run to your parents and everything's good. But when you're neglected, that's not the case. And so the child is just left alone to stew in the fear of the world. You know, just little things will scare them. You know, just normal things will scare them. There's a stranger that just came into the house, and it could be like the plumber that the parents hired, but to the child, it's this massive threat. And because they don't understand how the world works, it's just really scary. So this locks in this experience for the child of a constant danger, a constant threat, which will blossom into something later, of course. Also, because individual children are actually under, so what I'm talking about so far is just imagined or distorted threats. You know, a lot of children believe threats are out there that aren't really actually threatening, like the plumber, for example. But children are also under actual threat, possibly because of parent abuse or older sibling abuse or something. So there's a rational evaluation of threat and danger the child is going through. But because of the neglect they're going through, they're just left in a stew of threat and danger. And thus, they lock in to this schema of paranoia and suspicion of the world, of other people. So remember earlier I was talking about the individuals would have these odd perceptions. And one of them, a common one, is feeling like there's a shadowy figure or someone is watching them or someone's going to hurt them just around the corner, or there's just a sense like someone's going to get me. Well, it makes total sense when you think about that experience for the child. The neglected child with the disposition is just in this constant state of real and imagined threat and no attunement, no relief from it. And so the neurological pathways of worry and threat and assumption of threat become locked in. You know, what fires together wires together, right? Becomes this very well-worn track in the brain that just fires automatically throughout the day. And so the individual might not be able to point to an actual threat when they're an adult, right? They're 25, they suffer from schizotypal. If you ask them, well, what's actually threatening you, they might not have a clear answer to that, but they're very convinced that a threat is looming constantly, right? Now, they will project that into people because when things feel a certain way, you will often try to adhere reality to the way that you feel. People with borderline have the exact same issue, right? But with a different schema of abandonment and or betrayal. They will interpret their relationships with other people as being inherently abandoning and betraying, not because there's any indication of that, but because it feels that way to them, and they will operate on that assumption. Well, for people with schizotypal, it's the same thing, but it's instead of worries of abandonment and betrayal, they are worried about danger, actual threat of their life, right? Of being snuffed out of existence. So neglect leads to this feeling of threat that becomes locked in. Another experience that children will have potentially from this neglect is they will give up on emotions. So due to neglect, they never learn how to interpret their emotions. I've talked about that before. And so they don't know their own emotions and they don't know other people's emotions. And so they give up on emotions neurologically, not as a choice, right? They actually neurologically will, the pathways involved in understanding emotion and expressing emotion never fully develop or shut down or something like this. And so people with schizotypal will have inappropriate, what they call in DSM, inappropriate emotions as adults because their neurological wiring is such that the emotions haven't really fully synced up with themselves and with external stimuli, if that makes any sense. And or they will have very constricted affect, very constricted, restricted emotions because their neurological pathways involved in emotions have become very attenuated and very weak. And so they're having emotions, they're having opportunities for emotion, but because of this early neglect and the child just learning over time that there's really no point in having an emotional expression, the system involved in that gets shut down. So another thing that happens due to neglect is sensitivity to criticism. And I haven't really talked about this yet, but it's related to this paranoia. And the way to think about it is that due to the neglect the child's going through, they become really concerned about criticism because they believe that if they can avoid criticism, then they can avoid being neglected. And or they feel like they're being neglected because the parents think there's something wrong with them. And thus, later in life, when they're 25 and they're being mildly criticized, they can feel very hurt by that because it reminds them of being massively neglected growing up. And the last result of neglect that is particular to people with schizotypal personality disorder is that the child will turn to magical thinking that will be retained into later life. So due to the neglect, the child's magical thinking will not only be enhanced and exaggerated, but will also persist into early adulthood and beyond. All children have magical, almost all children start out with some aspects of schizotypal personality disorder, i.e. magical thinking. Basically, the inability to differentiate between reality and imagination, right? Also, ideas of reference, meaning everything is about them. Most children, like if you talk to a three-year-old and they have their stuffed animals and they believe that the dog is actually talking to them, or that the elephant is real, or that their figure of Luke Skywalker actually has a soul within. You know, the children have these magical ideas, or they might believe that when they're pretending that they actually are those things, right? It's normal. It's totally normal, and we don't think anything odd about that. But that eventually gets modulated by reactions with the environment and with a lot of attunement and learning that they experience through other people, through relationships, that there's a difference between imagination and reality. Well, for people who are neglected, they might not be given that opportunity to differentiate in that. Also, when you're being neglected, you might have a need to dive further into your imagination and further into magical thinking as a way of coping with the neglect, right? You might need imaginary friends. You might need people to talk to you. You might need entertainment, right? So people who develop schizotypal personality disorder, who have the disposition, who have the breeding ground of neglect for schizotypal, as adults, they will have a harder time differentiating between imagination and reality. For example, the shadowy figure just around the corner that's out to get me. For me, since I was raised well enough such that I was able to develop that different, that, you know, to differentiate between imagination and otherwise. So let's say that I'm walking around in a new neighborhood or a new town and I don't know anyone, and I have a feeling of danger because I don't really know where I'm going, or I don't know, or maybe more specifically, let's say I have a new job and I arrive at work and I don't know any of these people. I barely know the people who even interviewed me. And so I have a sense of threat. I have a sense of danger. I have a worry that maybe people are thinking bad about me, that they're judging me. It's a worry that I have. It's normal. And there are intrusive thoughts like, ooh, that person who just gave me that weird look, they must hate me. Okay. Because I was raised well enough, I have a robust neurological system that can reality check and look at that and say, well, you're probably just making that up. You don't really have any evidence that they actually are thinking bad about you, and you feel like you're under threat, but you're not really under threat. Most of that is just your worries, your imagination, your paranoia, your concern, that kind of thing. And those things are real, and we can pay attention to that, but there's a difference between a feeling of threat and actually being under threat. Now, for many people, we're talking about differentiation. We're talking about the ability to have self-awareness around this. We're talking about like social anxiety, this kind of stuff. But for some people who have extreme neglect growing up and extreme lack of attunement growing up, they might neurologically actually have a deficit in the ability to differentiate between those two things, such that they feel so real to them that, you know, someone comes to me and say they went through a fair amount of abuse growing up and they have a fair amount of lack of differentiation. And they come to me and they're like, yeah, I was at this new job and, you know, this new coworker of mine, you know, she was saying this and that. And I investigate, and because I know the client well enough, I start to suspect that my client is being fused and undifferentiated at work. I'd be like, okay, well, can you tell me what the coworker said exactly and what led you to believe that you thought that they were against you? And then over time, I start to question. I sort of say, well, you know, is it possible that the coworker didn't really think much of you, or might have been suspicious of you, kind of, but you're blowing it out of proportion based on your own schemas and your traumas? So for someone that doesn't have schizotypal personality disorder, even if they have a different personality disorder, honestly, there's a chance, there's a pretty good chance that if I work it right and we have a good enough relationship, that at the very least they can introduce a question mark on there. Because neurologically, there's a pathway that allows for that question mark, allows for that differentiation between imagination and reality. Whereas people with schizotypal, not all of them, but maybe many of them, neurologically, it's actually very difficult for them to even comprehend that. Similar to the way that if you talk to a three-year-old about the difference, or maybe even younger than that, it's easier to understand, like an 18-month-old child, to have them understand the difference between imagination and reality, to that's too much to ask of them. They haven't developed that that way yet, right? And there's a lot of nuance on this, and there's a lot of developmental things that we can get into, because it's not like 18-month-olds are completely in la la land, but I hope you get my point. So for someone with schizotypal, I can have that conversation with them and be like, well, are you sure that they were really against you? And for this, particularly the you know, severe schizotypal individuals, they will say, no, you understand, I can sense things. I know that I can't say they said anything overt to indicate that they were hostile, but I know 100% that they were being hostile against me, because I just know that, because so as they're describing this to me, there's no basis in reality, and yet they're 100% sure of it because it's the way that it feels. Okay. And this is potentially, and again, according to the way that I think about it, and there's no way to demonstrate this, there's no way to study this, because we don't have the ability to look at this neurologically yet, but this is my model, that the individual never developed past that point where the difference between feelings and intrusive thoughts and imagination and reality was able to be developed in the brain. Okay. So I hope that makes sense. So as an adult, the individual feels like the signs are telling them things, or feels like the trees are telling them things. They don't really hallucinate things because they're not psychotic, but there's a feeling, you know. Well, I'll talk about for myself. I love trees. I grew up in Sammamish, Washington, in a house that was completely obscured by trees. We could see one neighbor kind of, but we lived in a forest. The forest wasn't ours. Our lot was actually quite small, but there were a lot of lots, you know, house lots, that properties that had left their forests untouched around our house. You know, it was a lot of backyards with a lot of forest, pine trees and maple trees and alder trees and blah, blah, blah. And as a child, I just grew up with a lot of forest, tall trees around me all the time. And so I have a fond feeling about trees. And whenever I have chosen to live in a particular neighborhood or a particular house, I've always favored houses that had a lot of trees. The house that I'm in right now in Seattle, a lot of trees. Most of the view, particularly when the leaves are around in the summer and springtime, it's really hard to see other houses around my house because of the trees. I love trees. I get a very good feeling about trees. It soothes me. I one time moved into a house that had a lot of trees in the backyard, and as soon as I moved in, I hugged all the individual trees because they were the same trees that I grew up with as a child, cedar trees. And I have a very fond feeling about trees. If I were schizotypal or I was a two-year-old child, I might actually extend that good feeling about trees to feeling as though they have personalities and they're talking to me, and I'm communing actually with a living creature, an actual creature with a personality, with an intelligence, with sentience. I'm interacting with the trees because I have such a fondness for them. You know what I'm saying? So if I didn't have that ability to differentiate between imagination and reality, I myself might feel as though trees had their own minds, their own souls, right? And so this magical thinking aspect of schizotypal is not only retained from childhood for those children who have the predisposition and also the neglect, but also the child might lean into it because it gives them comfort. It gives them someone to interact with. Okay, so you have the biological disposition, and then you have the neglect, which results in feeling under threat, giving up on emotions, being sensitive to criticism, and turning to magical thinking. So now you're suspicious and you're odd in your behavior. Your emotional expressions are strange, and you don't have a lot of interactions with other people to guide you on how you're supposed to act. And because you don't really understand emotions that well, you have a hard time gauging what other people are doing or saying or feeling. And so what this results in is as you enter the world in preschool or middle school or you know grade school, middle school and beyond, it creates a lot of negative interactions, maybe even with your own family members. And so this results in the social anxiety aspect of schizotypal. The child isn't born with the social anxiety, and they might not have the social anxiety at the age of two necessarily, but as they enter the world, they start to try to interact with other people because they have the same desire for attachment and entertainment and interaction and acceptance. But because they're assuming everyone is against them, and because they have a very limited understanding of emotions and themselves or other people, and because they have this magical thinking which causes them to be kind of odd, right? It results in a lot of negative experiences socially. And so they learn over time that social interactions and other people are really quite scary to them. And so they develop this extreme social anxiety because of that. Also, they begin to behave oddly because they feel cut off from other people. They will cut themselves off from other people. The emotional understanding isn't really quite there, and thus they will have a hard time learning how to interact with other people. Like, for example, for me, I will say that all my abilities in terms of communication and voice inflection and hand movements as I'm talking, you know, if you've ever seen me talk, I guess, in a video, all the ways that I talk and move and behave, it has been learned. It wasn't born communicating this way, right? Well, how did I learn it? Well, I interact with other people and I saw how they did these things and I mimicked it or incorporated it and tried it out. And then people reacted to me in a certain way. And some of my, you know, experiments with behavior didn't go well. And so I would stop doing that and other things tended to go better. And over time, fast forward 52 years, I now have this way of being, but it was shaped socially, right? Well, if you feel cut off and you cut yourself off socially, and you also have a hard time interpreting other people, then you're not really given a chance to piece together a presentation, just a natural way of behaving, thinking and talking and walking that is in line with the way other people act, with that's in line with helping the other people feel comfortable or even how to communicate. Because remember, there was that aspect of people talking these very formal ways, these odd ways. And my hypothesis, and you know, there's no way to know this for sure, is it's because of this phenomenon, this experience that I'm talking about. You have the disposition, which, and then you have the neglect, and then you have the turning away and the magical thinking and the emotions that are shut down. And you don't have the ability, you don't have the breeding grounds for experimentation and learning and interacting with other people to learn how to act in a way that makes other people feel comfortable or in a way that communicates even what you're trying to say. And also, these individuals will learn to avoid relationships altogether, right? They might even learn that it's easier just to assume that they don't need to be with anyone and they don't want to be with anyone. So they'll convince themselves that they don't need anyone else and they're better off on their own. And then the last place that we get to in this flowchart is that this individual with schizotypal will become deeply unhappy. They might become depressed. They might have suicidal thoughts. They might turn to substances. They might turn to the internet. A lot of people with schizotypal will turn to the internet and have addiction to the internet, which can exacerbate their schizotypal symptoms, can cause them to be more suspicious and more paranoid, that kind of thing, more cut off. And so it all plays into each other. And the typical person with schizotypal is quite anxious, quite depressed, quite unhappy. Again, often substance addiction as well as a way of just trying to numb out or cope, or sometimes they need substances in order to interact with other people, that kind of thing. So that's my conceptualization. So to review, we have the disposition biologically, you have the emotional neglect that's quite pervasive, the child retains and has additional reason to feel constantly under threat, just in general, particularly from other people. They shut down their emotions, or they kind of give up on the emotions, or they're not really given an opportunity to understand emotions. They become sensitive to criticism. They turn to magical thinking. They enhance their magical thinking. They never are allowed to let go of that fusion between imagination and reality. They enter the world with these traits, and it results in a lot of negative experiences with teachers and friends and other kids and maybe even their own siblings and family and stuff, which results in a lot of social anxiety, a lot of isolation, and a lot of behaving in odd ways, and that results in deep unhappiness. So I hope that makes sense, because if that makes any sort of sense to you, then at least you understand my conceptualization of schizotypal personality disorder. When I landed on this, and it really was cobbled together over a number of weeks as I was looking at all the research and reading all the different accounts and thinking about my own clients with this, I'm guessing I'll refine it over time a little bit, but, and even as I'm reading it right now in my notes, I'm just like, I think I want to rework that a little bit. But generally speaking, this is how I look at a lot of, if not all, the personality disorders in general, just kind of as a general perspective of schemas. And antisocial, maybe not so much, potentially. Although, maybe when I get into antisocial, I'll talk about, because I think I have two different conceptualizations of antisocial. Anyway, that's getting off track. My point is that when I understand this, what emerges out of the neglect and the disposition and the things that are retained and enhanced in early childhood and how that complicates relationships later in early childhood, you know, in 5 to 10, and then how that reinforces some ideas and beliefs and schemas and thus results in coping mechanisms that we see in the behavior of schizotypal, it all makes sense to me. It just completely holds it all together. It's like I can see the pathway. I can see that flow chart that results in observing a teenager and an adult with what we call schizotypal personality disorder. And it also very much delineates between what I'm calling schizotypal, or the essence of schizotypal, and mild schizophrenia, right? Because mild schizophrenia is really quite different than this. But you can imagine, you could see how they would look very similar if you understand what I'm talking about in terms of the personality disorder and the distortions and the schemas. It's a neurological thing, right? The magical thinking. But it's a very different experience, very different presentation, very different cause, very different treatment protocol than for someone who has mild or emerging schizophrenia. So if you could let me know in the comments section on Patreon if this makes sense to you or not, that would be helpful to me, because this is the core of my lecture on this, is this idea that I've been going over, what I believe to be the cause, the flow chart to it. If it makes sense to you, that's awesome. If it doesn't make sense to you, what questions do you have? Because I'll try to clarify that. And that'll be the end of chapter 2. Tune in next time when I start chapter 3. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.